Episode number 193 with Carlos Welch. Welcome to the Heads Up Poker Podcast. This is Steve Barton, and thank you for tuning in. I am here with your favorite guest and mine, Carlos Welch. Thanks for coming on again, Carlos.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Yes, yes. That goes both ways, likewise. So the last time we talked to you was about 2 months ago, and almost exactly, actually, it was the beginning of September, and here we are, the beginning of November. Fill us in. What have you been doing?
Well, that's pretty convenient because 2 months ago, right before we recorded, I think I recorded from Mike's house right before I left on my way to Portland to substitute teach.
Yes.
And my plan was to teach for 2 months and then come back. And I just wrapped up those 2 months and I just got back to Mike's place.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So you're house sitting right now.
Sort of. Yeah. Yeah. So he's here this time, but so I'm just here basically haven't decided. I'm gonna be here for 1 week or two, and then I'm going to head across the country for the holidays back to Atlanta.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Cool. And how'd the teaching go?
It was great, man. Actually, I ended up coming back earlier than I expected because the original plan was to go up and then sub maybe 3 or at max 4 days a week. And that would kind of stretch it out a bit, but also not be, I didn't want to like feel like I had a real job.
Yeah.
But it was so easy that I just ended up going like every day for 2-3 weeks at a time. And I got in the number of days I needed to do quicker than I expected to because I was basically doing it full time.
Yeah.
And so Portland is the only place I know of where subs get medical benefits. And so in order to qualify for those, I have to work 70 days during the year. So the plan was to do 35 days in the fall and then come back and do 35 days in the spring.
And not one more?
No. Yeah. My plan is to not do one more. Unless poker goes to shit, then okay. I'll just probably do a lot more. But at no point, I don't care how bad poker gets, I'm not going to be anywhere north of the Mason-Dixon line during the winter.
Good for you, man.
Yeah. So, yeah, 0-10s. Luckily, poker's going pretty well right now, so I got options when it comes to whether I work or not. But if somehow things go bad in the spring, then I'll just, like, you know, teach summer school again. I had to do that last year or earlier this year.
Good, good. Yeah, strumming through your Twitter feed, it looks like you've been probably a little bit of playing well and running well.
Yeah, there were some growing pains recently over the past couple of months because I just started getting coaching from Ryan LaPlante, mm-hmm. and trying to implement his style is just so much different than anything else I've played myself or heard other people teach. And so because of it's such an extreme style, I'm making mistakes along the way. And that caused me to lose some money. And I was like, fuck this shit. I need to win some money. So I kind of went back to my own style, which I created. And I'm going to say, fuck it. I created this style. And it crushes on Bovada. So I had this dilemma where, okay, I figured out something that works. Because it's working, I'm making money, and now I got all this extra money. What am I going to do with this money? It's a good idea to reinvest and get coaching.
Yeah.
And I get coaching from a better player who changes my style, which causes me to lose. And it's like a paradox. Do I keep trying to master Ryan's style and get to his level? Or do I just keep sticking with what works, even though it only works because my opponents aren't trying to win?
Yeah, yeah. That's it, because he does not play on Bovada, correct?
Right. He does not play on Bovada. Mostly mid to high stakes stuff on ACR and mid to high stakes stuff live.
Okay. Yeah, that is interesting. I did an episode, the last episode of I had Ace Jack offsuit, and I'm curious to get both your perspectives on this. Carlos pre-coaching and Carlos post-coaching, and maybe Carlos, well, maybe three different scenarios. So pre-coaching, okay. Pre-coaching, and post-coaching.
Okay, so this works out perfectly because there's actually three different personalities there.
Okay, good.
There's Carlos, there's Carlos, and then there's Carloser. So Carlos was just like, you know, learning from Andrew Brokus and Tournament Poker Edge and just kind of like, you know, finding my way or trying to approximate GTO, basically. Yeah. And Carlos was like realizing, fuck this GTO shit. These people aren't even trying to win. So just do the most obvious exploit. And then Carloser is, and obviously just by the name, that meant playing looser than GTO. Yeah. And Carloser is like throw everything out the window and open Jack Deuce suited from under the gun. so that was what Ryan is trying to teach me. And obviously there's more to it than that. But yeah, I got definitely three brains in my head that I can tackle this question with.
Okay, good deal. Maybe we could combine them all and come up with the optimal answer.
Yes.
Okay, so we're nine-handed. We have ace-jack offsuit under the gun. Now, in live setting, if I'm sitting down at, I don't know, a win tournament, and I look around and I recognize four other regulars that are, you know, I know they're going to be like three betting me, and ace jack offsuit, I just dump it. Right?
Right.
On ACR, nine handed, ace jack offsuit under the gun, I could kind of go either way. You know, if it's a tighter table, I'm raising it. If it's a looser table, you know, where people are three betting me, I'm probably just going to let it go. I remember Alex Fitzgerald saying that on average, this hand makes a third of a big blind under the gun when you're nine handed. And I'm like, you know, is this really worth it? You know, so I'll kind of dump it depending on the table. Now at this Bovada table, it's a turbo. At the buy-in, it's a 30K guaranteed. So the buy-in is over 100. It's less than 200. I think it was like 135 or something like that, or 125 or 109. And the stacks behind us are, okay, so we're under the gun with 60 bigs. And the stacks behind us are 21 bigs, 18 bigs, 27, 24, 18, 48. And the small blind has 43, and the big blind has 35. Now, this table's been pretty active. In other words, there's been a fair amount of three bets, and the shorter stacks have numbers here of 39, 29. What is that? The 18 big blind stack has, he's got a three bet of 15. And I don't know. What are you thinking here in your three different brains?
Honestly, I think they would all open this hand. Okay. Mainly because you said we are 60 bigs deep, but we also have the table covered. And so this hand is a problem, like level one, when everybody's 100 bigs deep, because this hand, like you said, doesn't do so well versus three bets. And also, even if you don't get three bet and the flop goes like, you know, four or five ways, this hand is going to most often make one pair, which you're not going to be like in love with if a lot of chips go in a multi-way pot. And so none of those are an issue from these stack sizes. I mean, maybe getting three bet, but honestly, your entire range should be changing here. So for example, when you're 100 bigs deep, maybe you want to open a hand like 8-7 suited or 9-8 suited, deuces, like hands like that, where they can perform a little bit better versus a three bet, because you can just call to try to end the set, or two pair better with a 9-8 suited. But as your stack gets shorter and as the effective stack gets shorter, those hands should be dropped out.
Yeah.
And so basically you should be the composition of your opening range should be changing to where the speculative hands, the small pairs, small suited connectors should be dropping out as you get shorter. And those should be replaced by these big card combos that are now more valuable for their blocker value. And now also, if you made one pair post flop, you can kind of go with it because the SPR is going to be so much lower than before.
Okay.
So yeah, this hand, I think definitely should be in, your range almost regardless of which style you play. The difference here is Carlooser, who's like Ryan, like the Carlos version of Ryan, with min raise here, and Carloos with 3x.
Okay.
And my main issue here is you said the big blind has like 48 bigs or something like that?
The button has 48, the small blind has 43, the big blind has 35.
Okay, yeah. So this is a perfect spot.
And everyone else has between 18 and 27.
Yeah. So for sure, the three versions of me will all open this hand, but one would min raise it, one would go like 2.5, and the other one would go 3.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
See, as I'm reviewing this for a second, as when I recorded it last week, I'm like, yeah, whatever, just fold it. And then as I listen to myself while I'm driving in my car, I'm like, you know, maybe that wasn't an open. And now that I'm looking at it again for probably the sixth time, I'm kind of liking the 2X here, because the 2X open allows, okay, so we got 21 bigs, 18, 27, 24, 18, and then we got the bigger stacks on the button and the blinds. So if we get shoved on by like the 27 big blinds or the 24 big blinds, I think we could probably fold it if we min raise it. Now if we get into the like 3X range, I feel like it's approaching a call. But if we make it the min raise and the 21, the 18 or the 18 shoves on us, I think we got a call. Does that sound that, to you? Or?
That's exactly what Ryan would say. And okay. Because of that, that's what Carlooser would do. Min raise and fold to a shove. The difference is Carloos, which is my own personal style, I would 3X it because, yeah, when you min raise and somebody shoves, you can't fold because you're giving yourself a worse price on a call. But if you 3X, A, you're going to get shoved on a lot less often. And B, when you do get shoved on, it's going to be by a stronger range. So even though you're getting a better price to call, that doesn't matter if they're only doing this with like, you know, nines plus and ace queen plus. So the min raise, I can see people shoving on you with like, you know, ace 10 or fours or queen jack suited. When you 3X, they're going to think, okay, I don't have a lot of fold equity here. This guy probably has something like tens or ace king or ace jack, something strong. This is how I read into big opens. And I think a lot of other people do this also. Big opens are often considered hands that are strong but are vulnerable. So they don't really want to see a flop. They either want to take it down pre, or they want you to shove on them, and they're just willing to get it all in pre. Yeah. And so if people think that's what you want, then they're going to try to disappoint you by either one or two ways. They flat with hands that they should be shoving or folding, or they fold hands that they should just be shoving. Like, it's amazing how often I would 3X in this spot with Ace Jack, and I on Bravado, you can go back and see the hands later. Some guy just, like, folds Ace Jack or, like, Ace Jack suited when they started the hand with, like, 18 bigs. Like, sure. If you're getting people to fold hands like that,
yeah,
or flat with it by 3X opening, then my opinion, the pros outweigh the cons for that size. But Ryan disagrees with me, and he's a much better player than me, but the jury's still out on it.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, that was a mistake folding then. Okay.
Oh, so you didn't even open this hand?
I did not. No, that's as far as it goes. It was the question: do we open or not?
Okay. Yeah, and so, with 100 bigs, would you open the hand?
100 bigs? Probably no. I have the similar thoughts that you do. I like opening like pocket threes there, and I like opening Jack 10 suited there. You know, just kind of throw a little wrench in the system. And like you said, you're so deep. Sometimes it just folds all the way through and you just collect the blinds and you're like, wow, I did that with seven high. When you get three bet, you can comfortably call and you're like, okay, I've only put in 7.5 big blinds at this point. Let's try to flop a straight draw, a flush draw or two pair or something like that. And we'll go from there. 100 big blinds deep. No, I don't believe I'm opening this hand. I am opening ace queen.
Okay. So Ace Jack off with 30 bigs. Do you open in their case?
Okay, same stack sizes behind us.
Yeah.
See, that's interesting. Because here I have 60. Do I do it with 30? Yeah, I believe I do it with 30.
Okay. So, like, when you say you have 60, like in your mind, you're closer to that 100 big blind mentality as opposed to the 30 big blind mentality.
Yeah. Okay.
And see, the reason I think that thinking is a mistake, because really you should be thinking of the effective stack. Yeah. And so even though you have 60 bigs here, in reality, you're only playing 48 of them. And that's if that one guy gets it in with you. This, like, on average, you're really playing like a 30, 35 big blind stack here.
Yeah.
And so if that's the stack you actually have, you would open if you would open Ace Jack if you actually had 35 big blinds, then you should also open it in cases where you're playing 35 big blinds effective, even though you actually have more than that in your stack.
That's a very rudimentary and very basic point. I feel like I missed it.
yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, let me blow your mind on this also. It's funny, like, this is a simple hand, but it's a great illustration of the three styles. Give me a great opportunity to explain the three styles. So, since we're basically playing, like, you know, 35 bigs effective on average, Ryan is going to be opening pretty tight from this spot. Like, if he's opening Ace-Jack, off, which I think he is, this is towards the bottom of his range. Maybe ace 10 off, maybe ace jack suited, but he's starting to fold hands like ace 6 suited, maybe even like ace 2 suited, probably pairs below, like sixes and below even. Like, he'll start tightening up from, I'm just going to say 30 bigs because it's just, From a roughly 30 big blind stack, I actually get looser at this point. So here's the weird thing: Ryan starts off with like 100 bigs. He's opening, well, let's say like 200 bigs, hand one of the tournament. If he thinks the field is soft, he's opening like Jack Deuce suited under the gun, and okay. I'm pretty tight in that spot. With a lot of bigs, like we just established, I wouldn't even open Ace Jack off.
Yeah.
So he's wide when he's deep, and I'm tight when I'm deep. And then as he gets shorter, he loosens up his range. But as I get shorter, I widen my range. And the reason being, if I don't win some pots now, I'm going to be in that red zone pretty soon as I go through the blinds once or another orbit or two through the blinds, and then the level goes up. All of a sudden, I got 20 bigs. And I definitely don't want to pass up on a hand like Ace Jack when that's the case. But honestly, I'm open a lot wider than that at this point. Jack 7 off, you know, 7-4 suited. Anything that is somewhat connected, I'm opening. Because here's my plan. I'm going to 3X. And I really don't care what happens after I 3X with the people behind me, because from their stack sizes, they're all shoving and folding. And if they shove, I got an easy decision. I'm opening crap. If they shove on me, I just fold.
Yeah.
But remember what I just said. I'm 3Xing, so they're going to shove on me less often. So what's usually going to happen in this case is it's going to fold around to the big blind who's sitting there with 35 bigs. He's probably going to defend the big blind because he listens to the podcast and he hears you're supposed to do that.
Yeah.
And he's going to call with some crap hand, and then I'm just going to triple barrel him off of it.
Wow. Okay.
And because I'm going to triple barrel him off of it, my hand almost doesn't matter.
So you're not at all flop dependent at that point. You've kind of made the decision when you raise with 7-4 of hearts under the gun and the big blind defends. You're like, okay, the move is bet.
Yes. And I'm flop dependent in this way. If the flop is a big card, say like a 10 or better as the top card, a lot of times I'm going to go for a delayed C bet. So like, let's say the flop is a jack, checks to me. If I don't have any equity, I'm going to check back. And if he checks to me again on the turn, then I'm going to bet him off his hand. Cause I think most people, if they flop top pair, they're going to check to the raiser, but on the turn they'll start betting. So if they don't bet the turn, then they probably don't have top pair. And also, they're probably not leading out with their gutter type hands. They're either going to like fold because there's only one card to come now, or they're going to call once and then fold when I bet the river. Whereas if they have a gutter on the flop and I bet, they're going to like sometimes they'll check raise it, other times they'll call with it. And if I'm not willing to like triple barrel in that case, then I'm probably, what's going to happen is I'm going to bet the flop. They're going to call with their gutter. The turn is going to come. I'm going to bet again. And either they're going to call because they're just sticky and they still have the gutter, or oftentimes the gutter will pick up like a pair with it on the turn. Like the turn kind of improves their equity, so they're going to call again. And then on the river, I can't really do my triple barrel now because a lot of times if the flop was jack high, it's still going to be jack high on the river. And this person's called me twice, so they very well could have a jack. And I don't think I'm getting them off a top pair. So I'm probably just going to beg twice and give up, which is the worst thing you want to do when you have like 7-4 suited at the open under the gun. So that's why I like checking back and doing like a double barrel bluff with a delayed C bet when the top card is big. But if the top card is like 8 or 9 or anything worse than that, then I'm triple barreling for sure, because that top pair is not going to be top pair by the river.
Yeah.
So if the guy defended 9-7 and a flop comes 7 high, obviously he's calling the C bet and half the deck is bad for him on the turn. And so I'm going to bet again. He's going to get a little squeamish, but maybe just like in the last example, he maybe picked up a gutter to go with his top pair. So he has to call again. And then if it breaks out on the river, now he's got like third pair or second pair with a bad kicker, and the guy opened under the gun and triple barrel shove. In fact, the guy who's doing this is that same Mitt who was just folding Ace Jack off under the gun earlier. So his stats are probably something like 15-10. Yeah. I'm not bluff catching this guy with third pair.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's basically what I look to do in these spots is a delayed c-bet, a delayed double barrel bluff on big cards. When the flop is a big card, and when it's a small card, I just go for three street triple barrel bluff, and it prints. And I think it prints because people on Bovada aren't that good. And so maybe if Ryan tried to do what I just described in his games, either on ACR or in some of the higher stakes live stuff, it wouldn't work so well because people do more like check raise bluffing and that sort of thing, or people have balanced check call down ranges where they're going to have enough hands in their range to call the triple barrel bluff on the river to make it unprofitable. But these guys don't. These guys, if they flop a set or turn two pair or something, they're going to check shove at some point on the flop or the turn, or they're going to lead into you on the river. They're going to do something aggressive along the way as a red flag to let you know that your triple barrel bluff is not going to work.
Yeah.
And when they just check call down, they're waving a different flag, which is saying this triple barrel bluff is going to work probably like 80% of the time because I have one pair.
Yeah.
And it's not top pair very often if you pick the right boards for it. So I don't know, man. that works, you know, really well for me on Bovada. And man, I know Ryan's got a bracelet, so I'm trying to listen to him. But I'm just getting killed trying to play correctly against these people who are just so exploitable on Bovada.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I will be raising this in the future, sir.
Yes.
Yes, please do.
No, it's I don't know, man. It's like, I'll put it this way. And this is what I tell my students when I coach this, put yourself in villain shoes and decide and ask if this approach will work against you. Uh-huh. And yeah, like if somebody did this to me, they would own me.
Yeah. Yeah, they would. Yeah. I'm not calling down with 9-7 there. You know, when the king or the ace hits the river and the guy's bet twice and he's betting again. Like,
yeah. And remember, we started with 30 bigs. So that river bet is going to be all in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's tough. And not only are you not calling off on that river, with one pair, the majority of your range on that river is one pair. Because if you flopped a set, you would have raised at some point. Or if you turned two pair, you would have raised at some point. So you're just completely vulnerable to this on the river, which is not a problem because, you know, just only people doing this is me and, you know, my students on the site and maybe a few other guys. But 80% of the population isn't doing this. So if that's the case, you don't really need to defend against it.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. I like it. Okay. I got another one that, do you have any hands? I don't want to just take up all your,
I do got an interesting one here that I want to get your opinion on.
Okay.
So this was a hand from, some $10 turn. I mean, 10K guarantee on Bovada. I don't even remember what the buy-in was. It's probably like $55 or something. Not really sure.
44 to 55, possibly a 33 if it's during a busy day.
Right. So we are eight-handed.
Okay.
And we are in the hijack at the 500,000 level. I can never remember how people say the levels. Like, do they say 1,500 or 500,000? 1-2. So I always have to start back at 1-2. Like, nobody calls level first level 2-1. is one too. So you got to put the small blind first.
There we
like
go.
That simple shit like that confuses me.
Okay, I'll say 501k if that helps.
Okay, so we're at the 501k level. We're in the hijack with 34 bigs, queen 10 offsuit, and behind us is a 12 big blind stack, 24 on the button, 12 in the small blind, and 25 in the big blind.
Okay. Small blind, big blind. Okay, so I'm assuming it's folded to us, right?
Yes. Folds to us in the hijack. We have 34 bigs with queen 10 off.
See, now this is interesting because you don't – you're not excited if one of the – if the cutoff with 12 bigs or the small blind with 12 bigs shoves on you. Because especially the small blind, I think, would suck.
Man. And even the button and the big blind, like they have 25 bigs, which a lot of people will just shove that type of stack also.
True, yeah. And, you know, two of them have a third of your stack and the other two have two-thirds of your stack. So we're never going broke here. But sometimes after scenarios like this, I'm all, how did I just end the hand with 10 big blinds? What just happened? 10 offsuit.
Exactly.
I don't know, man. This, you know, I've for the last like few months, I've just religiously been doing 3.1x after my session with Alex Fitzgerald, and the past couple of weeks, I've kind of been questioning, like maybe varying that at certain points and doing 2x or 2.2 or something like that. I'm wondering if this is a spot for that. And we just make it 2.2, hope to take down the blinds. And if we don't, hope we don't get 3-bet. If we do, let it go. Man, I think I'm probably just in a vacuum folding this. Do we have any numbers on the guys behind us?
I think there's a way to do this. Let's see. Let me try. I don't know if that's going to come up. Yeah, actually, we do. Damn, that shit's, can't read it. It's got, I don't know, like this default HUD on my holder manager is like blurred out. So I got to switch it to the Assassinato HUD so I can actually read it.
Little plug there for a friend.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right. So the guy on our left is a nit. He's running 9-4 over what looks like 57 hands. So all we have about 50 hands on everybody.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
So we got a 9-4 on our left.
The cutoff is 9-4 with 12 bigs. Okay.
Yep. The button is a 21-17. I have to click this thing. This is 3-bet to 0, 21-17. Small blind is a 17-10 with a 6% 3-bet. Mm-hmm. And the big blind is a 45-14 with a 0% 3-bet.
Oh. Well, sir, I, knowing this new knowledge, I like a raise, okay? Because I think the 12 bigs, he's only going to shove on you with a real hand. The button, he's more kind of like pro numbers here. He's the one I'm probably most concerned about. Small blind is pretty tight. I think he's only going to do it with a real hand. And the big blind is a calling station, which would be an ideal scenario to be in position against him. So yeah, I'd probably raise this.
Right. And see, the thought process that you just went through was like a big jump in my game, I think, that I made after busting the main event. I didn't play it last year. So the year before that, that's when I kind of like invented the Carlos style out of frustration. Okay. And that's because, you know, we learned this GTO style that tells us to like do the right thing and play the right ranges. But those, that recommendation comes from an assumption that our opponents are playing well. So you're like, right away, you're worried about the button because he can, like, if we open too wide in this spot, he can three bet, or any of these guys can three bet and put us in like a really shitty spot. And that's supposed to happen a decent percentage of the time when stacks is this or this short, but it's not because these people aren't playing correctly. Yeah. They're too tight, or so the tight guys are going to be folding hands they should be three betting, and the loose guys are going to be calling with hands they should be three betting. So if they're not showing any aggression pre-flop, then we're leaving money on the table by playing these correct, quote-unquote correct GTO ranges. And I think their mistakes allow us to kind of get outside the box here a little bit.
Yeah.
So this is exactly what I was saying early. Like, I think Ryan would probably fold this hand. And me, before I started doing this myself, I definitely would fold this hand because it's not in the opening hands charts. Yeah. And then me now is like, fuck all that shit. I'm opening this, and I'm also opening 6-4 off.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. My cards almost don't matter. And, okay. and like I said earlier, the problem here, yeah, you're going to get 3-bet if you min raise, but not if you 3x.
Yeah.
And also, you're going to get flatted here a lot if you min raise by like the stationary type people, but less often if you 3x. So, yeah, I would open here for a 3x, and I would do it with an incredibly wide range.
Interesting. Okay. Now, what against a 3-bet from the cutoff against 12 big blinds?
Fold,
because he's a 9-4. Like, he's after 57 hands. It's just.
Yep. And when he shoves, he's short. Like, you know, I'm not going to do this math right now, but let's say if we 3x and he shoves 12 bigs, we probably need something like 30 to 35% equity to call him. And against a normal 3-betting range, we probably have that. So we can call, but if the guy's only 3-bet shoving the nuts, then we probably only have like 25% of his range. So it's 25% equity against his range. So it's a fold.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you at 3.1, I just 3x here.
Okay.
And we get a call from the button. Okay. And obviously we get a call from the big blind because he's a station. Never folding once somebody calls before.
Yeah, I was going to say his odds of calling there are probably like 125%.
Right. Here's another little trick I like to use in this spot. What do you think the button has range-wise? He started the hand with 23 bigs, and he just called off a 3X open.
Okay, I'm going to give him... Okay, he's at 21-17, so he's playing 21% of hands. He's raising 17% of them. He has a 0% 3-bet. After 50 hands, I try not to look too much at the 3-bet unless it's like a, you know, 20% or something like that. But I'm going to put him at Broadway's. I'm going to put him in pairs, probably from... Man, with only 24 bigs, this is Bovada. I'm going to say like fours through nines and tens. Tens he should be shoving. Nines he should be shoving. Okay. Smaller pairs, smaller to medium pairs. I'm going to say he does not have too many big pairs in his range. And... possibly like some suited aces and like some suited middling cards, like a 9-10 of clubs, jack 10 suited, stuff like that.
Exactly. See, these type of hands, first of all, I'll say the majority of the range that you just listed shouldn't have any of that shit. But yes. But you did the thing that I do often, is you start thinking about your opponent, and then you have to catch yourself like, well, this is Bovada. Yes. So like you can't even set mine right here profitably.
Oh god.
So no. He shouldn't. No. Yeah, so I'm 3x'ing, and he only has 23 bigs. He's not getting like 10 to 1, which is like the minimum you want in these spots. That's one. B, I'm opening from the hijack, so it's not like I have aces in. So even if you hit your set, you're not always going to get paid. So you need an even better price than normal versus if you were setting money against an under-the-gun opener. And on top of that, there's squeeze stacks behind, so you're not even going to get to see the flop very often. So he shouldn't even be calling here with, like, sixes. And if he can't call with that, he definitely cannot call with 9-10 suited or ace-5 suited. Like, those, all those type of hands should be shoves or folds.
Yeah.
But what I find in my experience here, when people make calls from these short stacks like this, they very often have like a suited Broadway hand.
Okay.
Or they just really suck and they have an offsuit Broadway hand. So that's what I put them on the majority of the time. If I think they're even remotely confident, competent. But yeah, some people will have like deuces here or something. Or like you said, 10-9, which would be a tragedy. Yeah. Or like ace-5 suited. And obviously, the big blind could have just about anything minus, you know, a lot of strong hands. And then maybe some, like, this is a great spot for him. If he's got, like, ace-5 suited or something like that, he might want to squeeze now because he knows that the flatter, he should be putting the flatter on the same type of hands we are. And that's basically dead money if he wants to, like, shove it in here against me. Like, if I'm the big blind here, I'm shoving like ace-5 suited, a lot of suited ace, and a lot of like big offsuit ace.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I feel the same.
Exactly. So if he doesn't have that kind of stuff in his range, and he doesn't have like the top, he has a lot of like weak mediums hands, and a lot of I'm going to give him like more or less complete garbage just because his numbers are so wide open, 45-14. So he may have like 7-5 off or something like that here. Who knows?
Yeah. I think he's even a guy that's 45-14 after 50 hands. I find it hard to believe that they're calling with things like 8-3 offsuit, although I'm sure that we could find exceptions to the rule. So I think he's folding like just the complete crap. But, you know, 6-4 right. offsuit, I think, is definitely square in a call.
Yeah. And if this was a live tournament, he would yell pot odds right before he calls.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that, I guess, but I'm priced
in. Be able to tell you what those odds were.
Exactly. Exactly.
We would never ask, but we all know he doesn't know what they are.
Right, right. He said, I guess I'm priced in.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, oh, thank you. You just told me you narrowed your range down to probably 12% of hands right now. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like they don't know we can hear them.
Yeah. Or know what they mean by that.
Yeah, yeah. So he calls, and now there's 10K in the middle, roughly. Okay. And both opponents, so the big blind has 23K behind, button has 20K behind, and I have 31 behind. So effective SPR here is like 2.
Okay.
The flop is ace of clubs, 10 of clubs, 6 of diamonds, and we have the queen of hearts and the 10 of spades. And the action checks to us.
Okay. With
second pair here.
Okay, so big blind, the calling station checks. And now it's on us. Okay, so big blind checked his 22 big blind stack, right?
Yep.
We have 34 bigs, and we got one guy with 21 bigs behind us. Okay. Okay, ace of clubs, 10 of clubs, 6 of diamonds. We have the queen of hearts, 10 of spades. Is the big blind ever checking it? Checking her way. Debating how much value there is in. Okay, I think we're getting called by. I mean, this is like super bad, but I think we might even get called here by some gut shots that the buttons got. We're definitely getting called by his aces, which suck. We're getting called by worse tens. We do block some of the broadways with queen. Damn, this is a tough one. What am I doing here? I think the bet fold. Well, 10K. I might do a bet of something like a third pot and trying to get action from a club draw, trying to get action from a worst 10, trying to get action from broadways that have a gut shot. The thing is here, when I have the clubs, I just feel like they're shoving everything. Check showing. You could get called by a six from the big blind. He is a calling station.
True. Very true.
Yeah, I'm probably betting like third pot into 10K. I'm going like 33 to 45. No, 45 to 8. I'm going to go 33 to 38. Final answer.
Okay. I think here, if you're betting for value, and if you're expecting to get called by a hand worse than yours, like a six, or like, I think the six is like the ambitious call that we're looking for, because we can only get that from one person anyway. Yeah. But we're obviously getting action from club draws and gutters and other 10x hands. But here's the issue with that. The action that we get from those hands are probably going to be check shoves because of the stack sizes.
Which they also do with an ace.
Right. And so, yeah, we want action from club, but we don't want to, like, bet call off versus clubs. And we're primarily trying to get action from draws. And when people have draws, when an SPR of two, they're usually not just calling with them, even if we bet small, I think.
That's a good point.
So for that reason, I think if I was going to bet here for value, I would definitely use a small size. But because we're trying to target draws that can just shove off of these stack sizes, I'd rather start by checking. Now, if we're sitting here like 50 or 60 bigs deep, then I'd definitely use a small bet size here, because now a guy with a club draw is either going to just call, and the passive guys are more likely to just call. And even if they do raise, it won't be all in. So we can decide to, like, bluff catch if we want to.
Okay.
But in this case, I like a check, which is what I did.
And then gets around, yet, like, from the button, he may he's going to probably bet his clubs here. Is that your reasoning, or he may check them behind? And
I don't really know what he's going to do with them, but I do. Okay, so if he has clubs, and I bet, I think there's a really strong chance he's going to shove. Yeah. Now, when I check to him, I can see him either checking and trying to, like, just get there, or betting, in which case I can call. Like, I can check call versus clubs, but I can't bet call versus clubs, because the bet call is going to be all in.
Yeah.
The check call is going to be, like, probably half pot or something.
Yeah, okay.
So I check around to him and the button, and he bets 3,000 into a pot of 10.
Okay.
So what are we thinking about? What he would do that with?
I think he'd do it with clubs. I think he'd do it with an ace. I think he'd do it. Would an ace go bigger there? No, I could see an ace going smaller. Okay, clubs, an ace. I mean, we did say that he could be calling there with like, 10-9 or something, which he should not be doing. So don't call there in this spot with 24 bigs on the button with 10-9. But on Bovada, we will see that. I think he could be betting that. An ace, but 8-9 bet there with a gut shot. I think that's pretty, that's super bad. Possibly like king queen or king jack with like the king of clubs, something like that.
Yeah. I think the majority of his betting range here, like you said, is gonna be clubs, like you said, the gutters that may have a club in the hand, like king queen, king jack. And you mentioned aces, but I think the majority of his range, the majority of his, like his big aces, just get it in pre.
Yeah.
And the small offsuit ones, like ace three off, is he really just flattening the 3X with that hand?
Maybe.
So if we look at his pre-flop range, he shouldn't have a lot of aces in his range at this point. Ace king, ace queen, ace jack, ace 10 maybe. Those type of hands I expect to just shove up open pre.
Yeah.
And the hands like ace deuce off, ace three off, like those type of hands should just be folds. So if he has any aces here, I think it's got to be like the small suited wheel aces. And even those probably should be shoved pre. But, you know, I think at best, those are the only ones he can have. And with the ace of clubs being out there, that just leaves like three suits. So like ace deuce through ace five of three suits. So that's deuce three. That's like 12 combos.
12 combos, yeah. Well, what do you think he's doing with like ace six, ace seven, ace eight, ace nine suited?
Honestly, he should just be either shoving or folding those pre. I would probably lean towards a fold with those. But this is Bovada.
Yeah.
So maybe he called with those also, but definitely not the offsuit versions.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay.
Yeah. So he's got like, you know, a few small to medium suited aces that obviously aren't including the clubs. And then just a whole bunch of like gutters and club draws, and maybe even he was like set money with like deuces or fours or something, and decided to like bluff now because I didn't bet. Like oftentimes when it checks around to the last guy to act, they'll try to bluff in these sort of spots.
Okay.
So I think he's got some bluffs and some draws and a few small suited aces. So that's how we range him. And the big blind makes it 12.
12K?
Yeah. Which is more than half his stack. He's put in like 12 and he's got like 11 left.
So you check raise. I don't know. When a calling station raises, that's kind of like a red flag to me. I'm probably letting this go.
And just, I agree with that. I agree with that.
Credit for okay. I don't know what you got. I'm going to put you on at least an ace here.
Okay, let's range him. He's kind of in the same boat as the other guy. In terms of the big aces should just be shoved pre.
Yeah.
The only difference is that he can have offsuit aces here because he was just closing action in the big blind.
Yeah.
So he can have a hand like ace deuce off. Question is, if he's a station, is he raising with a hand here?
Is he raising with a...
If he has ace, so he defends ace deuce off, checks to the razor who doesn't bet, and then the button bets out here. most stations, when it gets back around to them in the big blind here, if they have an hand like Ace Deuce off, they're going to just call. They're not going to check raise with top pair, no kicker.
Okay, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something aggressive. An aggressive player might do, but a station type guy, I don't think he's raising here with too many one pair hands.
True.
So with that being the case, what value hands does he have? He doesn't have a set of tens.
No.
He doesn't have a set of aces.
No.
So
ace 10, ace 6. He's got, I mean, maybe a calling station would do this with like king jack of clubs and king queen of clubs. That's only two combos.
Or you know, four deuce of clubs.
Okay. You know,
yeah, because stacks are so short that I think even a station would be looking to get it in with a flush draw. And the same reason I didn't want to c-bet the flop, because I was afraid of getting check raised by a flush draw. Like, I think that still applies here. I mean, he may just call with it because he's a station. That's an argument. But I wouldn't be shocked to see somebody check raising here with a flush draw, even if they are a station. Now, maybe it kind of sounds like you're leaning towards a station is going to be more likely to do it with a stronger flush draw. Like you said, king jack of clubs, or maybe something like, I don't know, 7-6, where he's got like a pair and a flush draw.
Yeah.
So I think his range here for value is going to be kind of slim, because again, a hand like ace 10 suited, a lot of people would just ship that in pre versus opening a flat. Like, it's a really good squeeze spot for him. Anything better than that, then I'm super confident that he's going to shove in pre a lot, like ace king, ace queen, ace jack, those type of hands. But maybe he flats ace 10 suited, maybe he doesn't. Ace 10 off, I feel like he's probably more likely to flat. But I think he's going to have ace 10 here a lot, maybe ace 6. And I mean, definitely ace 6, but so ace 10, ace 6. I don't know if he has 10-6 off, but there's two combos of 10-6 suited.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he does with pocket sixes pre-flop. Like, it wouldn't be a bad shove, squeeze shove when you're starting with 20 bigs. But maybe he flats with that too. So I can give him a few combos of value hands. But the ones like ace 10, but like I'm blocking those a bit, and I think maybe he puts in like the suited ones pre. And I think the majority of his range here is going to be like draws, I think. Because he's got because he's defending from the big blind, he's got a shitload of clubs. He's got all the gutters, like king queen, king jack. Also like, you know, 9-8, 8-7. Who knows? I mean, he's a station, so maybe he doesn't play like the weaker gutters this way. And also because he's so short, he may even have like some 10x hands in for value. Which may is kind of tough with him being a station. I don't know what he does with a hand like jack 10, queen 10, king 10 here.
Yeah.
Because like the fact that he's a station is kind of at odds with the fact that the SPR is 2. So
yeah,
even those guys are going to kind of just go with a hand sometimes in these spots.
Yeah, when they have, they're probably calling there with Jack 7 suited. When they see two clubs, they're like, this is a check, get it in.
Yeah. Where they would never check raise in this spot if they had 50 bigs. But with only 20 bigs, like, what else are they going to do?
Yeah.
So when I looked at this spot, the way I thought, I think for sure the check raise on the flop from the big blind, I think is going to be two pair better, or it's going to be some type of draw hand. Yeah. And because I think he's going to get in pre with a number of his ace-x combos, probably all the sets, and maybe some of the like ace-10 combos, I can remove a lot of the top of that range out. And because he is defending from the big blind, he's got a lot of the bottom of that range, the draw type hands, like the clubs. Like, he's even got like, you know, 7-deuce a club in his range, where he wouldn't have that from any other position besides where he is. So I'm thinking this guy has clubs a lot here.
Okay. I like the way you articulated that.
And the guy on the button, like, your first thought was he could have an ace, but then you said, would he bet that size with an ace? Like, his bet kind of looks to me like either a cheap steal attempt or like a blocking bet in a way where he's just trying to get the showdown cheaply with, you know, some mediocre value hand that may be stronger than mine, like a hand like ace five or something like that. I don't think he has two pair or a set here very often. And honestly, I don't even know. You know, I guess that's, I guess that's a period, the end of that sentence. I don't think he has two pair or a set here very often. So honestly, I think he could have an ace or maybe a better 10 than mine. But if I shove, he has to fold.
Yeah.
Even if he has like ace five and I shove, there's a lot of heat behind. Like, he bets the big blind who's the station raises, and then the original raiser check shoves. Like, he can't be super happy there with like one pair.
Yeah, if he's sitting there with ace three, then he's got to be like, well, am I good? You know?
Yeah.
How often am I good here?
Yeah, and this is a play. I coined a term for this play in an article that I wrote for Poker News probably like a year, maybe more than a year ago now. Call it the value bet bluff. So I shove in this spot, and I'm shoving it for value against the big blind because I think he has clubs here a lot. But I'm shoving it as a bluff against the button because I think he has like a better 10 or an ace here a lot. So it's like I'm bluffing one guy and value betting against the other guy all in the same hand.
Interesting.
It's kind of cool, though.
It is. I like it a lot.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Like, the example hand that I wrote in the Poker News article was a lot better than this hand, even though, like, the setup here, I hope I explained it well, but I think the setup here was, like, perfect for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only thing that would make it a little bit better is if the big blind was not a nit, because you did make some, not a nit, if he wasn't a station, because you did make a very good point about anytime a station does something aggressive, that's going to be a red flag. But I think there's that paradox between that and the fact that he's short, that, you know, those two things kind of like are at odds with each other. Yeah. And this time I just hope that the shortness would allow even his station ass to do something aggressive with, you know, 7-deuce of clubs or whatever he has. That's what I was hoping for. So I check shoved. And the button call with aces, and the big blind call with ace king.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Was not putting those hands in their ranges.
I walked through the whole thing and eliminated those before we saw a flop.
Yeah, me too. So this was a case of me getting screwed by two people who did something so extreme, such an outlier line they took from what most people would do. And so I lost a hand. I don't really care because I think this scenario is going to happen like one time out of 1,000. Yeah. Probably 20 to 30% of the time, the big blind is just going to have a pretty strong hand here, like ace 10 or 10 6 or something like that, and I'm going to lose either way. But like the button, no way did I think I would ever get called by him.
Yeah.
I think his range is on, like the top of his range here in my mind is like maybe like ace jack. And maybe like ace jack should get an in pre. Something like ace 9 would be like the top of his range. And I don't even think he can call with that versus a check raise and then a reshove over the top of that. So he was just like him flattening out with aces and then having the ace come when the other guy actually has an ace in his hand. This was like such a unicorn for this to like not work out for me that I don't mind losing to the button because I think that's going to happen probably one time out of 1,000.
Yeah.
Big blind, I think I'm probably going to lose to him like one time out of like, more like 200 times out of 1,000, 200 or 300 times out of 1,000. Yeah. And I think the rest of the time, I think I'm just getting it in against the big blind who has some type of club draw or a gutter or a weaker 10. No, he wasn't. He wouldn't. Let me think about that. No, he's not raising that on the turn. Mostly draws.
Yeah,
on the flop. When he check raises, they're basically all in. I think he's got two pair better or clubs. And I think he's only going to have two pair better a small percentage of the time. And then I just have to, like, fade the clubs.
Mm-hmm.
But the cool thing is, like, even if he has, like, king, queen of clubs where he's got two overs, it's roughly a flip, but it's a flip with dead money because the big blind is never calling unless he just happened to flat aces.
The button is never calling unless he flats aces, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so I thought this was a pretty cool spot that didn't work out for me. And after this play was over, I kind of kicked myself a bit because I think what I did in this hand was pretty good poker, but it was some unnecessarily good poker against some people like I'm playing Mozart to a cow, in this spot. mainly like I think this is going to work like 70, 80% of the time for me. But in order for me to take advantage of this spot, I got to risk my entire stack on one shot. The plan here when I opened this hand was to have the big blind flat me and then me try to bluff him off whatever he has over three streets, which gives me multiple shots to, like, kind of get it through.
Yeah.
Here, it's all or nothing, an all or nothing bluff shove or value bet bluff shove on the flop. And it's just, this would be required if these people were not super exploitable in other ways for smaller numbers of chips. And that's a lesson I have to keep telling myself because it's not, people don't think this way. Like when I get coaching, it's like if you have a good spot, go for it. And I don't think I need to do that so much on Bovada because I can pass on tons of marginal spots that cost me my entire stack, I can pass on them because I can take fist pump spots that don't cost me my entire stack because of the mistakes that my opponents make.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a lesson I have to keep telling myself. And so far this week, I've been sticking to it. I can think of one or two hands I wish I had back. But for the most part, I've been crushing when I think about, you know, just throw jabs. Just throw jabs. Like, this was a fucking uppercut combined with a 360 roundhouse.
Heyman. Yeah.
Yeah. And I missed and got punched in the nuts.
Yeah,
now, exactly. I didn't need to do all this. But I do – it is a good exercise in, like, thinking through a hand and finding – I think this was a plus EV spot, but it's just I had to risk my – this is a plus EV spot that I had to risk my entire stack to take when these guys are willing to give me plus EV spots that I don't have to risk my entire stack to take. And in a tournament, I definitely should be more focused on the second kind as opposed to the first kind.
Did you ever play Mike Tyson's Punch-Out on Nintendo?
Yeah, Mike and I was just talking about this the other day.
A bald bull doing his charge. A white guy just punched you in the stomach and you went down.
Yep. I remember. I know exactly what you mean. There was like a sound that went with it, I think. It was like a it was something like that. Yeah, that's exactly what happened here.
Yep. Oh man!
But look what they had to do.
Got that joke?
yeah, for sure. Yeah, none of the younger people even know who Ball Bull is.
What if that game was big in the UK? I don't know.
That's a good question.
interesting. That was a good one. Okay, I got one here for you got a couple minutes?
Yep.
Okay. I got one here. This is Bovada. It's a it's when they're running their GSO or GSPO6. I don't know what that stands for, but
Golden Spade Poker Open.
Yeah, there we go. I've been wondering what that was. I even tried Googling it and I couldn't get the answer. I'm like,
yeah.
If it's not on their website, it's got to be there somewhere. You knew it. Okay, event number 7, 30K guarantee monster stack. So I'm guessing, again, the buy-in was over 100. Okay, blind levels are 400, 800, and it folds to us in the small blind. We've got A6 of hearts. Now, the effective stacks here are 25 big blinds. We've got 48. The big blind has 25, and we got A6 suited. What
position are we in? Cutoff?
Small blind. It folds to us. Okay, small blind. So we're gonna be heads up here with the big blind.
What's the big blind stats?
Big blind stat after 14 hands is a 21-14.
In that case, I just complete.
Okay.
Through
your reasoning.
Do we have a 3-bet percentage on him?
3-bet 0.
Okay. 48 bigs at this stage of the tournament. Is this one of these tournaments? Did this tournament start with, like, I guess that doesn't matter. Yeah, it does kind of matter. Is this one that started with like 10K stacks or 5K stacks? Like, are we a big stack at this point with 48 bigs, or are we kind of like right in the middle of the pack?
We're kind of a big stack. It started with 10K in it started with 15K in chips. And
oh, okay.
Yeah. So he's got 19K, we've got 38K. Yeah. He's got 25 bigs. We got 48. And we're, I guess, entering the middling stages, probably beginning middling stages because it's 400, 800.
Okay.
You know, getting close to the no more registration. I think no more registration stopped at like the 1600 level, if I remember.
Gotcha. Honestly, this. Okay, I'll take it back. This could go either way. This is basically how I decide in these spots is if the guy's a station, he's going to call my raise. Yeah. And that's not going to be good for me with the majority of my hands. So I'm just going to limp because I don't want to bloat the pot. And then, like, if I see bet against the station, he's going to call a lot. And now the pot's just completely out of control on the turn. So against stations, I like to limp in a lot. Against aggressive players, I like to either shove or limp shove because I can, like, what do aggressive players want to do? They want to raise. So I don't want to, like, raise and have them shove over me. They're going to do that pretty wide. If I limp, they probably won't shove over me because they got 25 bigs. It's too much. But they may raise, and that just allows me to limp shove. And against a knit, I'm always just going to raise and take it down. So I was trying to figure out in which of these three categories to put this guy when you say he's running 21-14. But those numbers don't really fit any of those categories. So that's why I'm a little bit confused here. So in that case, I have to default to like population tendencies, and the average person on this site is a station. So for that reasons, I think I'm going to just forget about his HUD numbers and just assume he's a station, which is why I want to limp.
Okay. Okay. I do the same. I limp. My intention here was limp shoving. You know, if he checks behind, then we see a flop with what's very likely the best hand. And if he raises on us, I feel like you said, if we raise and he shoves, that just sucks because we have ace six. You know, I'd rather limp, have him raise, and then I could shove over the top, and I think he's folding quite a bit.
Right.
Okay. All right. I do that. I limp, and then he raises to 2753. So he raises a little bit more than 3x the big blind. And then we stick to our plan here and we rip it. And then he snaps us off with jacks. So it, I think after losing this hand, I was like, well, maybe there's another line that I'm not seeing here, because I feel like if he's got 20 big blinds, I'm just shoving ace whatever every time when it's folded to me in the small blind. You're doing the same thing.
Only if I can't find a better line. And so the reason this hand is so confusing is because we don't really have enough information on this guy. So we just have to kind of guess. You guessed he would be over aggressive in this spot. And who knows, maybe he is over aggressive, but you just ran into the top of his range. If I have 20 bigs and I think the guy's over aggressive, the problem with 20 bigs though is I think he may just shove himself. So if that's the case, 20 is kind of a gray area. 15 bigs, I'm definitely shoving because I know if I limp, he's going to shove pretty wide. If I think he's also going to play 20 bigs similar to 15, then I'm going to do the same thing and just shove myself. And I don't think he's just going to rip with 25, which is why I like the limp shove here with 25. This is just a shitty spot because of the lack of information.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I think his stats are somewhat reggy, but I'm not just going to assume somebody. If I don't know enough about somebody, I'm not going to default to, oh, they must be a rig, not on Bravada.
Yeah.
If I don't know about enough about them, I'm going to default to the fact that they're probably a station, which would kind of lead me not towards not limp shoving because stations aren't raising wide. But that would be my thought before he raised. Now, his numbers kind of look somewhat marginally aggressive. And then he does something aggressive after I left. Now I'm assuming that, okay, he can't be a station because he's probably not a station because he had somewhat active stats and he just did something aggressive. So he's probably over aggressive. And I would have played the hand the exact same way.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But I'm only with 20 bigs, I'm only just ripping it in pre if I can't think of a better line. And usually there is a better line when you have more information on a guy.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I've got one more. Do you have any others?
I don't. No.
All right, let's see. We have, I'm going to have to do the math here, 14 big blinds. Okay, so the blind levels are 1250, 25K. This was a 3K guarantee turbo. You started with 10K in chips.
Okay.
Okay. Under the gun, who has us just covered, he's got about 16 big blinds. He min raises to 5K. We get one fold, and we're in the low jack, and we have pocket eights.
Is there any reason why this isn't the easiest shove in the world?
Okay, that's what I thought. This is just a snap shove, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought so. Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking at him. I was like, did he say 41 bigs or 14?
Okay, good.
So maybe I heard that one wrong.
Okay, good. All right. That was it. That was my one hand.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that was quick because I did have a question I want to ask you.
All right, go ahead.
I remember you talking about that you did the eBay store. And I remember you kind of talked a little bit about the numbers. I don't know how detail you got. But I'll just kind of like, just to make it easy, I'll just kind of pick your brain on this. If that was something that I wanted to do, I won't say full time, but say if I wanted to like do it for like 20 to 30 hours a week.
Okay.
Like how much you think I could make doing that in like a year?
Interesting. Okay. Now I was doing eBay and Amazon, but the majority of what I was doing was Amazon.
Okay.
And the way I was doing it was kind of unique. Okay, so basically, since you're mobile, you're going to basically need to get the stuff and then ship it off to Amazon. Because otherwise, what a lot of people do on Amazon that don't have the Amazon 2-day Prime as a seller, they got to keep the shit. And so they got to store it in their garage or their attic or something until someone clicks buy. And then they got to go up there, put their label on it and ship it off directly to that buyer. So you make a little bit more money that way, but now you got to store all this crap, right? And right. Not only that, but you got to be there all the time when someone clicks buy and you got to get it in the mail right away, or you're going to start getting bad reviews, right?
Right.
So what I liked was I liked using the what they call it is they call it I believe it's called FBA, fulfilled by
Amazon.
Yeah, okay, that's what it is, fulfilled by Amazon. Now what that is you basically get your item, whatever it is, you know, you get a box of I'll use the best one that I ever got. It was a box of ice cube trays that were in like Star Wars figurine, you know, cutouts or whatever, so little kids could freeze Kool-Aid in Star Wars ice cube forms and then put it in their drink or something, right? Now, these things I got for about 10 cents a piece, and they sold on Amazon in a 3-pack for, it was a ridiculous margin. You know, I was making like $4 or $5 a sale, and that's after Amazon takes their cut, right?
Right.
So yeah, I got a box of these things, and they sold in about, 4 days or something, and it was the easiest couple $100 I ever made, you know, because it took up no space, they're extremely light, and you could mail them off, to Amazon for super cheap. It was just amazing. So if you're going to do that, what I did was I would go to auction houses, and I would find these deals. I would bid on them. And let's say an item is selling for $30 a pop on Amazon, you're going to need to get it for $10 or less. So you're going to need to get it for about a third the cost, because your third the cost, Amazon's going to take a third just through all their processing fees and all that, and then you'll make $10. You're going to need a printer, and you're going to need to be able to print out the labels and the barcodes that you put on each one of these items that's specific to you, so that when Amazon gets it to the warehouse, it scans it, and then it's able to rapidly find it with its robots and throw it on the assembly line.
Right.
So that's Amazon. eBay is kind of like the Amazon, the other scenario with Amazon that I was saying, in that you're going to have to keep all this stuff.
Right.
So you really kind of need like a processing center, for lack of a better word. And I just use my garage. You might be able to do it out of a storage unit. Like if you kind of have I guess you're almost getting kind of a home base up in Portland.
Home bases and houses and storage and all that stuff is like
cancer to you, or kryptonite.
Not cancer. A la carte, meaning that I can get this stuff if I need it, but only if I need it. So if I could do this and make like $50,000 a year, that might be worth getting the place. But if it's like, because I remember you throwing out the number 10,000 at one point, but I don't know if that was like how much you made in total in a year or in a month. And so I want to just know how worthwhile this type of thing would be if I just kind of like really went for it, because I got so much free time.
Yeah.
Like if I just really spent like maybe 4 or 5 hours a day on it.
Okay. You know what? This is what I'd recommend to you to start out. And this is kind of how I started out. This is exactly how I started out. I went to garage sales. Mm-hmm. And that will teach you the game. So you go to garage sales, you download this app on your phone called Profit Bandit. I think it costs $10 a month. At least that's what it did when I was using it. Mm-hmm. And it's this app that you can scan a barcode of whatever's there. If you see a doggy door, right, and you Jew the guy down to $3 and you see that it sells on Amazon for $40, you got a profitable one, right?
Right.
Now, keep in mind, the heavier the item is, the more it's going to cost you. So let's say you see a bowling ball and you find it on Amazon, and it's selling for $70. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you could do the third thing and try to get it for $23 and you're going to make a profit. No. You need to get that damn bowling ball for like $5, because the cost that it's going to cost you to mail it off to Amazon, and then for Amazon to mail it to the customer, which could be anywhere in the U.S., you know, and the cost of shipping is going to be more if they're really far away and less if they're closer and like that. You got to get it extremely cheap. I came across so many of these little child escape ladders at garage sales that sell for, I think it was like $50 or $60 online. Some of them brand new, still in the package, but unless I got the damn thing for almost free, like $3 or $4, it wasn't worth my time. You know,
gotcha.
Because it's just so damn heavy. So I would start there. I would get that app, and I would just go to garage sales and just start scanning stuff and find stuff that's profitable. And on a typical garage sale day, I could make $200 to $300. Now, I was moving. Like, I started at 7 o'clock. Like, I was up at 6, and I started at 7 o'clock in the morning, just driving from one to the other. They have all these little garage sale apps on your phone, so you can just bounce from one to the next, you know. And you know, you plan your day accordingly, so you can hit 25 houses. And you get this kind of feel of like you'll step out and you'll look at everything, and it's nothing but clothes. And you're like, I'm back in the car and I'm going on to the next one. Or you step out and it's a whole bunch of like kids' toys still in the boxes, you know, in almost new condition, and they don't even look like they've been played with. That's your gold mine. You know, you come across two of those, and then the other ones are kind of sprinkled in between with random little crap. Let's see, what's some other advice I could give you? I think that's where I would start. You're going to need some boxes. So you'll have to print out the labels. You'll have to find it on Amazon, print out your barcode, put it on the thing, and then put all those items into one box. You're going to need a scale as well. That's really important. When I first started out, I was basically picking up my dumbbell of 15 pounds and then picking up the box that I was mailing in the other hand and kind of guessing and going like, oh, it feels less, so I think it's like 12 pounds. I did that twice, and then I went and bought a $40 scale. The UPS guy was like, this is off by like 6 pounds. What are you weighing these with?
That is hilarious. Steve, the human scale Martin. Yeah.
So, so you are going to need a scale. I would say your initial startup cost for this would probably be get a scale, get that app. You're going to have to get some boxes and, you know, the labels to print out. You got to get the labels, I think, are 1 inch by 3.5 inches, and they come 30 to a sheet. You can just type into Amazon, Amazon FBA sticker labels, and it'll be the first thing that comes up. Just buy a little package of those.
Right.
And so, but money wise, when I was at my height, and now keep in mind what I was doing was I was paying a guy to do the auctions for me. I was paying a kid to help me process this stuff, because by the end of it, I was getting pallets of shit and I'd have to process all this in one day in my garage.
Right.
With all the labels and boxes and all that cost, I was going to Home Depot and buying a pallet of boxes and then bring it back. The last year, after costs and everything, we cleared about, I think it was 37 or 38,000. But okay. I was putting in about 15 to 20 hours a week. And that's just what I was doing. That's not what my other guys were doing as well.
Right. And the numbers that you gave, the 37, 38, was your profit after paying your employees and Amazon fees and all that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. That might be worthwhile to, and obviously I know it won't start off that way, and like, you know, you learn as you go, but I'll think about that as something to potentially get into.
It is. It would be tough doing it mobily like you're doing it. Although maybe it might give you an advantage, because I was kind of restricted to two auction houses, and one of them was like an hour drive away, which is a bitch because you had to drive all the way down there and drive all the way back. The other one was only about 20 minutes away, which was really nice. So I did that one 90% of the time. And then if there was some really good stuff down at the one that was an hour away, then I would throw in a bit there.
So from my understanding is, as long, because I'm not like mobile every day.
Yeah.
So like, for example, like you mentioned Portland, like I'll be back up there in the spring. And when I get there, I'll be there for 2 or 3 months. So I wonder if I could like do it during that time. And then maybe kind of like taper it down once I know I'm going to be leaving soon, so I don't have so much shit to like lug around. Or, never mind. I do have a storage unit where I just keep my personal stuff in. Like if I wanted to kind of like put some stuff in there and then just come back to it later, that's an option. or if I just want to make sure that I'm down to like almost no product before I move, and then like, you know, maybe do it in Portland for 2 or 3 months and then head off to Vegas for the summer, and then like maybe start it back up in Vegas, because the product is sold and shipped all online. So like the location where I am is on, I only need the storage when I have product in a particular location. It's not like I need to like rent a warehouse in Portland for like the 2 or 3 months I'm there. I can just like move around and do it. I think that I'm assuming that's how it works. But yeah, that's kind of why I wanted to ask you, like, if can I just like start it and stop it in 4 different locations 3 months at a time?
You could, yeah. And it really, it basically, the only time you have to store the stuff is when you get it from wherever you got it, the garage sale or, you know, the auction house. And then you take it back to wherever you're going to process the stuff. And once you process it, then you're just driving boxes to UPS, and then you're done. And the beauty of that is, like, and now you just sit there and you get little alerts on your phone every time you sell something, you know, so it's kind of cool. I loved it when I would go on vacation, because I would just work my ass off for like a month and just stockpile all this stuff. And then while I'm on vacation, I'm like, I made a fucking $1,000 this week, and I literally was sitting on the beach drinking a Mai Tai.
Yeah, see, that's what I want to do.
I love about it. Now, another big thing that I forgot to mention is when you scan these things on this app, it comes up with a ranking. Okay, so you can get a ranking all the way from number one, all the way down to number one, which means it's a number one seller, and they're probably selling 3 of these items a second. Or you can get a ranking of like 2.5 million, which means they're probably selling 2 a year. So you got to pay storage costs when you mail it off to their warehouse. They're going to charge you to keep the thing on the shelf every month, and they charge you by a cubic foot. I think when I got out of it, when I started it, I think it was something like 38 or 41 cents per cubic foot. And then when I got out, it was approaching the low 60s in cents per cubic foot. So I kind of got out at a time when I just got promoted at work. Amazon was starting to take more and more of a cut. And I was like, I could really only do one of these things well. I'm either going to sell shit or I'm going to be a fire captain. And I chose being a fire captain. So
gotcha.
That I've been out of the game now for 2 years. So
damn, that was 2 years ago.
I think so. Maybe it was a year and a half, but, yeah, probably.
We're getting old, man.
I know. No kidding.
I feel like I just heard that on the podcast like 6 months ago, but I guess, yeah, it's been a while, man.
It has been a while. Yeah. Well, you know, it's gotta be, because I got promoted, over 2 years ago, and that's when I quit it. Yeah. So it's been over 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe I'll just listen to the episode like 8 months after you guys did it.
That could be it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But okay.
Pay attention to that ranking, because if it's really high, you're probably not going to want to buy it. And you'll find really high rankings in books, you know? So you'll scan a book and it'll be, the ranking will be 250,000. It's probably going to take you, several months to sell that book. Meanwhile, it's sitting on the shelf and it's costing you
exactly
4 cents a month or 7 cents, or I don't know, depending on how thick the book is, or, you know.
Yeah. Just okay, I'll keep that in mind. This is, you know, I'm just looking at a couple of avenues to kind of like dip my toe in, because, you know, since I've started subbing, I definitely got more liquidity, and I want to like do something with this money as opposed to like, you know, just letting it sit there. You know, I got some in Bitcoin, but I don't want that to be like the only thing I got going. So yeah, the next year or so, I'm going to be looking at different things I can do to kind of like reinvest my money.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that would definitely be an option. It's a lot of work. But it's a fun game, you know. I mean, it's there's no feeling like it, because I remember, you know, going to sleep and then waking up in the morning and I'm like, I just made $42. I had $150 in sales and I made $42 while I was sleeping.
You know, yeah, see, that's so awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a neat feeling.
Yeah. Well, anything like that that's just like scalable, yeah, that's something I'm, you know, look into, you know, at least try. And the cool thing about it is not like you don't have to get a $10,000 business loan to start something like this. You can just kind of start small and just see if you like it or not. And yeah. So yeah, that's what I'm looking to check it out. Give it a shot.
Yeah. I'd be curious if you do it or not. And how the game has changed. And I think generally speaking, it's probably about the same. You know, if you start doing it and you get hung up somewhere, because their customer service for customers is 5 stars, their customer service for sellers is about 1.5. So
yeah,
you have a question, you minimum time you're spending on the phone is 27 minutes. It's almost like they have a fucking plan to that. You know what I mean? Because every time you call, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. And then they got to go ask their manager, and then they come back and they give you some answer that you've already read and knew. And then you got to tell them, yeah, I tried that. They'll be like, okay, let me talk to my supervisor. And then you're on hold for 3 minutes and then they come back and it's just like, oh God, it's like, if they would figure that out.
I'm
on a tangent here, but
I can tell you still got some pent-up frustration over this.
I do. I'm like, these are the people that are making money, the sellers. Like, what the fuck? Get some people behind the phone that know what the hell they're talking about.
You know what you need? You need a Amazon MP3 from Elliot Rowe.
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do not sell one item until I listen to that man's voice first.
That's so great. That's our Elliot plug right there. Get your 7 minute till poster in the show notes. You know where it's at.
That's funny.
Oh, I love it. Right on. Well, thank you for coming on, Carlos. If you guys want to get a hold of Carlos for coaching, you can go to headsuppoker.poker, click on the Circle of Trust, and you have his coaching tab right under there. And follow him on Twitter, at HipHop101Trivia. And you got any other plugs in there, Carlos?
No, that's it. The Twitch stream has been dormant for now. I don't think I have any other projects coming up. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. Coaching is probably like the number one thing I want to plug right now, and you got it.
No. Awesome. Yeah, and if you guys want to support the podcast, it all goes to charity. Use our Amazon link. You can get that at headsuppoker.poker. Click on the Support Us tab, and anything you buy, it's not going to cost you any extra. Some little percentage goes to the podcast, and it goes to a scholarship. Thank you for tuning in, and here is your weekly motivational speech.
The reason you feel so uncomfortable on the inside is because you know you're not being the best version of you that you can be. That discomfort is trying to move you from where you're at to where you belong. Your destiny is greatness. And you know this on the inside, and that voice just keeps on calling, and you're never gonna have the peace until you go become who you are supposed to be. Now, we're gonna set this change in motion for you right now. I want you to say this with me. I want you to say this out loud. I am ready to change my life. I am willing and committed to going all in and fully commit to doing the things that it takes to become the person I was meant to be. And that starts right now. All excuses stop right now. I will not, from this point forward, point the blame at anybody else for my own destiny. I will take responsibility for who I want to be. I will get up every day and work toward that person that I know that I am on the inside. I pledge with all my actions allegiance to success. I will search deep down inside for a why that will allow me to run through walls with it.